On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. The northwest provinces of Pakistan have long been a home base for al-Qaeda terrorists. But with a burst of bombings and armed clashes spilling into the rest of the country, and with alarming new intelligence reports out of Washington, there's been a dawning realization that the rugged region is the other great hot zone for global terrorism. None of the solutions looks pretty, and Pakistanis fear they may be looking at a new little war within their own borders. Up next, On Point, we'll look at the mountains of northwest Pakistan and the threat that lurks there. Joining me now from Lahore, Pakistan, is journalist and analyst Ahmed Rashid. He is widely regarded as one of the top experts on the Taliban and the security situation in Central and South Asia. And his books, such as his book on the Taliban, are must-reads in the counterterrorism community. Ahmed, so nice to have you with us. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Tell us, first off, help us understand exactly where this region is, this lawless frontier. Where exactly is it?
Well, this is in the northwest corner of Pakistan, adjacent to the northwest frontier province. And these are seven tribal agencies, altogether perhaps no bigger than Belgium, maybe 4 or 5 million people in total. And each agency is inhabited by a set group of tribes. And historically, the British never conquered this region, but established a kind of indirect rule through appointing political agents. And that continued until 9/11, when for the first time the Pakistan Army went into the tribal agencies to try and prevent the escape of al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden from Tora Bora. And the army didn't go in properly, it didn't occupy the heights, but since then we've had an inconsistent policy by Pakistan, in which Pakistan sometimes goes in and is very assertive and tries to crack down hard on the militants, and sometimes goes in and makes peace deals.
Mm-hmm.
And that has been the whole problem.
Before we go into those peace deals and the inconsistent policy of the Pakistani government, describe for me first what these areas actually look like. Are they sophisticated little cities? Are they a cluster of straw huts? I mean, just describe them for us physically.
Well, they are, you know, I mean, this whole area is extremely mountainous. And if you remember the pictures of Tora Bora, then, you know, that emulates a lot of the mountains in these tribal agencies. They're very difficult, and these mountains stretch into Afghanistan as well, so it's very easy to cross the border. There are no real cities as such. There are some villages, but mostly these Pashtun tribesmen, they live in fortified mud houses, which each mud house, which has an extended family of perhaps several brothers living together, their wives and children, each mud house is built like a fort. And literally, you know, I mean, a house is your fort, as it were.
Mm.
There's very little agriculture. There's very little job creation. Mostly what they're involved in is smuggling. Now, of course, narcotics from Afghanistan. But before, smuggling all sorts of goods between Pakistan and Afghanistan. Mm.
So these are fortified mud huts for the most part, or houses, as you call them. So often we hear of these terrorists holed up in caves or training around these areas. Not much of that, then, I guess, is there, Ahmed?
No, I mean, you know, the caves are very high up in the mountains. There's no water there. Accessibility is very difficult. It's a place to hide, perhaps, for a few days, but it's not a place to make training camps or to live there on a semi-permanent basis.
Mm.
As some of the militants of al-Qaeda have been doing. In fact, a lot of the al-Qaeda militants, both Arab as well as Central Asian, Chechen, Africans from East Africa, some of them have mapped into these tribes. They paid huge sums of money to the local tribesmen to be able to live down in these fortified houses. And, of course, it's extremely difficult for the Pakistan military to go house to house, as it were, right across the tribal agency
and
find out who's living where.
And who are these recruits? Who are these terrorists, these militants that are paying these huge sums of money, as you mentioned, to live in these areas? Where are they coming from?
Well, you know, it's a real hodgepodge. I mean, you have a lot of the people who escaped with bin Laden after 9/11 from Tora Bora living there. You have now Arabs and Africans coming into the region now because Afghanistan is considered, you know, a very good war as far as Al-Qaeda is concerned. You also have Afghan Taliban. And in the last 2 or 3 years, you've had the phenomenon of Pakistani Taliban, that is, local tribesmen who have become Talibanized. They may have started off as hosting these Arabs and foreigners and earning money from it, but they have now become very much influenced by Al-Qaeda, and they themselves have started a movement for Talibanization, not just in these tribal areas, but lower down in the valleys, in settled areas where they are large towns and cities.
Mm. A Washington Post editorial just this morning, Ahmed, cited the National Intelligence Estimate, which says that Al-Qaeda has, quote, regenerated key elements of its homeland attack capability. So you're on the ground. Define the threat for us. What's the evidence that that threat is growing?
Well, I think the evidence is pretty plain. In fact, if you saw the first bombings in Britain in 2005, it is now established that those British bombers, in fact, had traveled to the tribal agencies, linked up with Al-Qaeda, taken instructions or perhaps training, and then gone back. We've had evidence since then that Muslims from Canada, from Germany, from Holland, and again from Britain, have all been able to travel up to the tribal agencies and meet with certainly Pakistani Taliban, Afghan Taliban, possibly even senior members of Al-Qaeda. So that means that, you know, this area seems to be not only a base, but seems to be very accessible. You can arrive in Pakistan, and with the right contacts through local religious schools, you can actually end up in the tribal areas and meet Al-Qaeda. And this has been the case for the last, at least the last couple of years.
So other areas like Iraq, which may not be terribly accessible, unlike that, Pakistan is accessible. You can even go out there on holiday and then just sort of disappear, I guess, in these tribal areas.
Well, exactly. And in fact, a lot of the European intelligence agencies are spending a lot of time tracking their young resident, you know, Germans or British Muslims, German Muslims, who in fact, you know, are visiting Pakistan and then do literally disappear for 2 or 3 months at a time. What we have not had has been a scare that American Muslims or, you know, American converts to Islam have been traveling to this region. Now, we've certainly got a lot of reports that have been made public about European Muslims, but we haven't heard the same thing about Americans.
You mentioned earlier about the Pakistani government's policy toward this area and the militants there. What has the Pakistani government done to rein in Al-Qaeda and the Taliban in this lawless frontier, this northwest area of Pakistan?
Well, in 2004, when there was a lot of American pressure to go into the tribal areas and deal with Al-Qaeda, the army did go in. The army lost something like 700 soldiers. There was a crisis in the army because a lot of soldiers were not willing to fight. They were not willing to assault and kill their own people. There were desertions from the local militia forces and the military. So as a result of that, the army pulled out. What we saw after that was in 2005, 2006, a number of peace deals with the local militants. Now, Pakistan said, the government said that these peace deals were being conducted with the local tribal elders, that is the good guys, as it were, who would keep the militants under control, and the militants would pledge that they would no longer attack Pakistani forces nor cross the border into Afghanistan and attack American forces. Now, what happened after these peace deals was that the U.S. military found that, yes, the militants had stopped attacking the Pakistani forces, but they continued attacking the American forces across the border in Afghanistan. And obviously that increased American and Afghan frustration.
And has the money that the United States has spent over this period of time with those, in conjunction with those peace deals and after 9/11, I think it's $10 billion to this point. Has it made any difference, had any effect in tackling this problem, Ahmed?
Well, I mean, you know, clearly, according to the Americans, the problem is much worse now. I mean, you know, in 2001, this region was not the central mechanism of Al-Qaeda. Now it is. So clearly, you know, in 6-7 years, there has not been a significant improvement.
Joining me from Lahore, Pakistan, is Ahmed Rashid, author and analyst on the terrorist threat in South Asia, and a journalist who writes for the Daily Telegraph in London. With us now from Arlington, Virginia, is Seth Jones, an authority on counterterrorism with the RAND Corporation. He's traveled to Afghanistan and to Pakistan's tribal region to study the security situation on the ground there. Seth, welcome.
It's good to be here. Thank you.
You were just in Pakistan. What is your assessment of the Al-Qaeda threat in this remote, lawless northwestern frontier?
Well, I think the National Intelligence Council's estimate that at least the public part that was released recently summarized the situation quite well. It argued that over the last several years that Al-Qaeda and the Taliban, both of their situations have strengthened in the tribal areas. There has been a significant amount of training, recruitment, construction of improvised explosive devices, information operations that are coming from the tribal areas of Pakistan and focused on U.S. and other NATO efforts in Afghanistan, as well as to some degree the Pakistani government. And then, as Ahmed Rashid noted earlier, focused on a variety of other cities and countries. There have been Al-Qaeda attacks that have linked back to the tribal areas.
Such as London?
London. There have been attacks in a variety of other places, including India, Bangladesh, Spain. The Madrid attacks in 2003 with links back to Pakistan. So I think the national intelligence estimate, the analysis released publicly, probably gave the best public estimate of the security situation.
So the threat has strengthened. So from your perspective, does the Pakistani government, first off, have the capability and, more importantly, the will to actually go in, take control, do something about it?
Well, I'm not sure the Pakistani government has the capability in and of itself. I think what's been clear, if you've followed the Pakistani military incursions, as Ahmed noted earlier, it's been involved in operations in South and North Waziristan in 2002, 2004, 2005, 2006. One of the things that has become clear to me anyway, and this was visiting Wana recently in the tribal areas, is that the Pakistani military is not particularly well-liked. So sending large numbers of Pakistani military forces into the tribal areas is probably not a recipe for success. I think what is probably more appropriate is some sort of combination of Pakistani military and intelligence efforts working with local tribal groups. In a sense, a few months ago, there were efforts to combat Uzbek militants in the tribal areas, working with local groups. That is probably the most effective way to deal with them.
So the combination of Pakistani military working with local tribal groups, where does the U.S. Fit into that, and what are the different arguments or proposals being made in Washington about what to do in Pakistan?
Well, there is an open question in Washington about how much to get involved with or without the acquiescence of the Pakistani government. I think one major constraint with the U.S. military and its intelligence service, the Central Intelligence Agency, is that the U.S. is not well-liked in the tribal areas. So a large U.S. military response in the tribal areas is not really a viable option. In fact, it would probably be a recipe for increased recruitment among insurgent and terrorist groups in the area. So I think what the U.S.'s role and the direction that debate seems to be moving in Washington is that the U.S.'s role is primarily one of providing intelligence support and assistance to Pakistani military and intelligence organizations, as well as tribal groups on the ground, and then also to increasingly work with and in some sense pressure the Pakistani government to conduct more actions or work with local groups to conduct more actions in this area.
So I know that one suggestion, one prescription has been that in conjunction with providing this intelligence support and assistance, that there actually is an encouragement with the help of the U.S. and Pakistani governments to encourage a sort of local conflict, if you will, a sort of civil war in this area. Can you describe that scenario and why that might be effective?
Well, I think the issue really is civil war. Maybe slightly overstating the point. I think the issue really is to get tribe. There has and Ahmed Rashid noted this early, or something to this effect. There has been a change in the balance of power. I would argue in the tribal areas of the last few years. That is a shift away from Maliks and tribal leaders and towards religious leaders, including Taliban leaders. And so the argument would be to push back, to increase the power, provide assistance to local tribal leaders, to essentially take back power from Taliban and religious leaders.
And how would they do that? Through some sort of military conflict?
Well,
right?
I think this is largely covert assistance. This would be a combination of both economic reconstruction. But you're right. I mean, this would partly be conflict. I mean, this is it's a what we call low intensity conflict.
And best case scenario, under that scenario, tribal leaders would regain power. But how certain are you and others that kind of a conflict might be contained?
Well, I think that's an open question. And I think what we've seen recently with the spiraling situation in the aftermath of the Red Mosque incident in Islamabad, that there is certainly the possibility for suicide attacks, violence, demonstrations in major Pakistani cities. The question is whether that could be contained and whether most of the fighting would remain in areas like the tribal areas. I think that's an open question. I think that would depend on the competence of the Pakistani police and military and intelligence services in trying to dampen conflict.
Back to Ahmad Rashid in Pakistan. Ahmad, we've heard so much that Al-Qaeda, that its main base has broken up, that it's now mostly a satellite operation. Is that true from your perspective there on the ground, and how does Pakistan play into that, Ahmed?
Well, I think, you know, it's a bit of both. I mean, I think clearly there is still a central leadership and central command and control. Now, how effective that is, I mean, according to the Americans, that central command and control is on the Pakistan side of the border. Osama bin Laden, Ayman al-Zawahiri, and other al-Qaeda commanders. And clearly, foreigners who arrive, who want to carry out bombings in Europe, are able to meet these people and go back inspired or having got training or money or whatever the case may be. So there is an element of central command. But at the same time, there's a lot of fragmentation. I mean, a lot of these, for example, Pakistani Taliban groups that are operating are not unified. They are operating on the basis of their tribal loyalties and divisions. And what Seth is actually describing is probably very feasible, but also very complicated and difficult. Because you're not just dealing with good guys and bad guys. You're dealing with a lot of gray guys who are both good and bad, and you'd want to pull them out, if you like, and make them into good guys. And at the same time, it's very fragmented. And then you have the Afghan Taliban, who also have many factions, also living there and influencing the region. So it's a very, very complex situation. But I think, you know, it is doable if there is the will there. And I think at the moment what we've seen on the Pakistani side has been a lack of a consistent policy and the lack of will.
From your perspective, Ahmad, you talk about the fragmentation of the region. Seth and I spoke just a moment or two ago about this notion of encouraging a local conflict to let them sort of fight it out, if you will, in that particular region. How do you feel about that? Would that work?
Well, you know, one of the big problems in this has been the fact that there are elements within the Pakistani military and intelligence who have been backing the Taliban in Afghanistan. Now, that's that's a big problem, because there's a kind of degree of favoritism going on there. For example, after 9/11 was that both the Pakistanis and Americans went after the Arab component of Al-Qaeda or the foreign component of Al-Qaeda, but didn't touch the local Taliban, that is the Afghan Taliban and the Pakistani Taliban. Now, the big problem right now in Waziristan is precisely these two elements. So what we don't want to see is, again, this kind of favoritism that we'll touch one group but not the other group. Mm. There has to be a will there on the side of the Pakistanis to go after all the bad guys without discrimination or favoritism.
Let me turn to the phones, Ahmed and Seth. Some callers have questions for you both. Bill in Williamsburg, New York, is on the line. Hello, Bill.
Yeah, hello. First, I want to thank you. I think it's an excellent program, and the person seems very well-versed on knowing what's going on there. You've answered a lot of my questions I had, so I'll go further into it. I ask if you agree that something should be done, and it seems that you should, in covert operations, perhaps more economic pressure from world organizations. Do you not think it's time that the world join together, and how could we do that to get everybody on target to get these terrorists once and for all and just do away with them? I mean, it's come to that point now where, you know, you see it in Spain, you see it in Italy, you've seen it in London, you've seen it in the United States. They say they're going to do it again. Isn't it time to do that? That's my question.
Bill, thank you. Seth Jones, I'll let you answer that. Some sort of coalition, the world joining together to get this area under control.
Well, I think there are two points that are worth noting here. One is, I do think there needs to be, and there has been some degree with the National Intelligence Estimate release, there needs to be a recognition that the primary source of the problem, or at least the location of what we call core al-Qaeda, is not in Iraq, it's not in Saudi Arabia, it's not in Algeria, it is in the tribal areas and in this Pakistani-Afghan frontier. Mm-hmm. That is the general source of the al-Qaeda leadership, bin Laden, Zawahiri, Abu Ubaidah, al-Masri. And second, I think as part of that, there needs to be a recognition, particularly from the American standpoint, that adequate resources need to be devoted to dealing with this problem. Over the last few years, much of America's attention and resources have been devoted to the U.S. war in Iraq. I think the situation in the tribal areas has gotten so bad over the last few years that there needs to be a rebalancing of those resources.
Hmm. Ahmed, put your two cents in there. How much pressure is there now? Especially,
I agree with that completely. But, you know, what you spoke about, the $10 billion that has gone to Pakistan,
yep,
a lot of that has been spent by the military on buying weapon systems for war with India, rather than for, you know, war in the tribal areas. That is part of the problem. A huge amount of, you know, we're buying $4 billion worth of F-16s from the Americans. We are buying Sidewinder missiles, which are used against Indian aircraft. Now, you know, that's not the kind of stuff that really we need. And I think the lack of accountability on the American side has been pretty devastating. And that's been raised by Congress now that, you know, the money that is given by the Americans, you know, it should be followed through as to where it's being spent. I think the other major problem we are facing in the tribal areas is that basically the middle ground has been wiped out now by the local Taliban. That is that the tribal elders, the people who were opposed to Al-Qaeda and Taliban are no longer there. They've either been killed or they've been driven out. And there are many now living as refugees in major cities like Karachi and Lahore. Now, this is the problem. If you want to implement, for example, policies to arm the good guys or reconstruction and development policies, the good guys are no longer living there. That's the problem. Who do you deal with? Who are the implementers of these policies? Mm. You need local people to implement these policies. And I think this has been one of the tragedies of Pakistan's policy, that it has allowed the Taliban to bump off or drive off those tribesmen who would be helping the government right now.
I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point. Seth Jones, you just said that the primary source of the problem of terrorism in this in the world today is not Iraq, it's not Afghanistan, it is this northwest mountainous region in Pakistan. So give us a timetable with that as the stage. How might this situation with the tribal areas spread? How might this situation sort of be compounded in the months and years to come if we don't deal with it now?
Well, I think the easiest answer to that question is to look at what's happened over the last several years since the overthrow of the Taliban regime in 2001, at the end of 2001. This area has been a source of problems for terrorist and insurgent activity in Afghanistan. Suicide bombers have been recruited from, among other places, Afghan refugee camps in Pakistan. There has been some training done in the tribal areas. Improvised explosive devices are put together in these tribal areas, shipped into Afghanistan, put together at safe houses where they're used to target American, NATO, and Afghan forces. And as Ahmed noted earlier, there have been links to terrorist attacks internationally. So I think what you'd see if this problem was not solved is you would see increasing movements in this direction. That is, the destabilization of Afghanistan, the destabilization of the tribal areas itself, and the continuing source of international terrorism from this area. At the same time, I should point out that on average, I have taken a look at the roughly 91 insurgencies that have existed since 1945. It has taken, on average, 14 years for governments to defeat insurgents. So the point here is that if serious efforts are undertaken, it is not going to be a short war.
Ahmed, this is for the long haul, right? This is not going to happen quickly.
Yes, absolutely. I agree with you. I mean, and there have been major setbacks. I mean, for example, in the tribal areas, you know, you have to rebuild civil society, literally from scratch. You've got to bring back these tribal elders and people who support the government and empower them in some form or the other. All this is going to take, you know, you've got to do some social engineering here, which is going to take several years. The same perhaps goes in Afghanistan, you know, where you have to create the middle ground of support, you have to create governance and a bureaucracy and people who will spread governance. The same is not true for the tribal areas.
Lauren is calling from Marshfield, Massachusetts. Hi, Lauren, you're on the air.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
I was calling in because your tagline at the beginning of the program made me a little bit nuts, even though I think Seth has addressed the issue. You were talking about Pakistan being the new Iraq, as if the Taliban and Al-Qaeda were in Iraq, and they weren't. We know that. We've created them there by the war, and as Seth pointed out, we've been paying attention to the wrong place. So I feel in some ways my comment has been addressed, but we need to be clear that this is not a replacement for Iraq. It is a situation that was partially created because of our involvement and obsession with Iraq.
Lauren, thank you.
And I'll take my comments off the air.
Thanks so much.
Thanks.
Seth, do you want to address that?
Well, I think, you know, whatever happened in the past, and I think people will make arguments both for and against the war in Iraq, what has become clear now is that whether or not there were terrorists and Al-Qaeda terrorists in Iraq in 2003, and I think the evidence clearly suggests there were not, there are now. So that there is clearly a relationship between Al-Qaeda elements operating out of the tribal areas in Pakistan and Al-Qaeda elements operating out of Iraq. So in a sense, the point is moot to some degree because now both areas are a problem. But I do want to point out that at least from my perspective, the core element of this organization, its leadership structure, I mean, and this is not to suggest that it is a hierarchical organization, but its core leadership structure is not based out of Iraq. It is based out of the tribal areas of Pakistan. But Iraq is a problem today now.
Let me bring another voice into the conversation. Evan Coleman is joining us now from Arlington, Virginia, international terrorism consultant. In the summer of 2002, he went undercover in Europe to interview several radical Islamic activists linked to Al-Qaeda. Evan, nice to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
What's your perspective here? You've been listening to this to our caller Lauren and to Seth's response that Pakistan, is it really the bigger issue, the bigger threat, greater than Iraq and Afghanistan from your perspective?
Well, actually, I've had the advantage of having studied both conflicts at some length and actually reading what al-Qaeda itself is saying. And the reality is that there was no al-Qaeda in Iraq before we invaded in 2003. That's exactly correct. Al-Qaeda came there because we went there. But unfortunately, the reality is also that today, despite that mistake and despite, you know, any responsibility that we may bear in it, that the reality is there is al-Qaeda in Iraq today. There is a very formidable al-Qaeda franchise active in Iraq today. That's not to say that these people necessarily take every single last one of their marching orders directly from Osama bin Laden or from Dr. Ayman al-Zawahiri. They don't. There is an exchange of guidance. There is an exchange of priorities, of mission planning. It's very much a franchise organization. It's not a command and control top-down relationship, but that doesn't mean that it's not a problem. It is. The difference, though, is that Iraq and Pakistan, as per, I guess you'd call them al-Qaeda front lines, have much different uses. Iraq really is a front line to fight against the U.S. military and Iranian Shiites or Shiites in general. It's a place where if you want to go and you want to be on the battlefield, that's where you go. But Pakistan, at least up until very recently, has not been seen in that light. Pakistan has been seen as a place where outsiders can come, not having to worry about the intensive security regulations that might be in place in a country like Iraq, not having to worry about fratricidal violence, taking your life before you even got into a training camp, a place where you can go where it's semi-peaceful, and you can go underground, and you don't have to speak Arabic. That's the other thing, is that, you know, a lot of today's terrorist recruits don't necessarily speak Arabic fluently. Mm. Trying to get into Iraq without speaking Arabic fluently is a very dangerous mission. And we only know of really of a handful of non-Arabs who have made it into Iraq to fight with al-Qaeda there. So if you're not, you know, again, if you're not from the Middle East itself, if you don't speak Arabic fluently, Iraq isn't necessarily the best place to go if you're, you know, a homegrown al-Qaeda recruit.
Well, it's so interesting that you say that, and I'm curious how what you just said about how outsiders can come to Pakistan. It's easy to get into. They don't have to speak Arabic. I'm curious how that sort of works into the changing face of the terrorists. Gone are the days of the Muslim-only recruit. You know, is this sort of an evolution to the blue-eyed, brown-haired, born and bred in the West sort of terrorist?
Yeah, we're starting to see that. It's funny because Ahmed mentioned that, you know, we don't necessarily have many examples of Westerners getting into the tribal areas along the Afghan border. But if you look at the other side of the northwest frontier province over by Kashmir, there's a place called Balakot where there are a number of jihad training camps that have been run at one time or another by groups like Jaish-e-Mohammed, which is a Pakistani militant group active in Kashmir, also Lashkar-e-Taiba. Now, while these groups, you know, their explicit mission is generally focused mostly on Kashmir, these groups also have connections in Afghanistan. They have connections with al-Qaeda. And among Western jihadist recruits, organizations like Jaish-e-Mohammed, organizations like Lashkar-e-Taiba, are seen as a backdoor. In other words, if you don't have the phone number of Osama bin Laden or Dr. Ayman al-Zawahiri, here are organizations you can go to where they can test your pedigree. They can test whether or not you'd be a useful recruit, vet you, and then eventually say, look, okay, you deserve this. We're going to send you on to a more hardcore training camp. Mm. We're going to send you on to recruiters who can give you orders. And that's the other thing, is that at least among those in the West, both of South Asian, of Western converts, even Arabs, there is an idea in their minds that if you want to carry out a mission, a terrorist mission in the West, in the United States, in the United Kingdom, the only place where you can get orders, where you can get tasking from al-Qaeda to do something like this is not in Iraq, but it is in Pakistan. It is with Dr. Ayman al-Zawahiri. He is seen really as the person who blesses these operations, who puts them into motion. Mm. And again, this is in the perspective of even people that have never met him before. So, I mean, there's no doubt that Pakistan remains the major base for planning and conceiving terrorist operations in the United States and the United Kingdom.
Thank you. Let's go back to the phones. Nicholas calling now from Rochester, Massachusetts. Hi, Nicholas. You're on the line.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
I have a comment and a question.
Sure.
My comment is I don't believe that the United States can muster the troop strength to go into the tribal areas. We have all that we can handle right now. My question is, probably for Mr. Rashid, if he's still with us, how can we get the tribal leaders to join in with us? We're going to have to sell them something.
Nicholas, thanks for your call. Ahmed, would you answer that? How do we get the tribal leaders to join us, to be on our side, if that's possible?
Well, you know, as I said, there's a huge problem, because over the last 5 or 6 years, since 9/11, a lot of the tribal elders, the traditional tribal leaders, the people who would normally support the government, people who would normally oppose al-Qaeda, are no longer living there. They've either been killed or they've been driven out. Now, you know, these people have to be brought back. They have to be protected. They have to be given resources and empowered. Now, all this is going to take some time. But it's absolutely correct that without bringing back, tribal leaders and elders who will support a counterterrorism drive in this region, you're not going to get very far, because you need people on the ground who are going to back you and give you intelligence and also help develop the region.
Seth Jones, how fragile is Pakistani President Pervez Musharraf's government at the moment, and how much pressure is there on him to crack down?
Well, I think the recent discussions of Musharraf with Benazir Bhutto indicate how fragile his position is.
In what way?
Well, I think his preference would be to retain both civilian and military leadership of Pakistan. So the fact that he is at least talking to a sworn enemy is, I think, something that is indicative of the current situation he is in. At the same time, he has gotten some pressure. U.S. Vice President Cheney was in Pakistan in early 2007 and made apparently some quite critical comments about Pakistani participation in the tribal areas. So I think there has been, and there's certainly been, a growing sense in the U.S. Congress that Pakistan needs to do more in the tribal areas. One thing that Ahmed noted earlier, and this has come out in the U.S. press as well, is there have been questions about which side the Pakistani intelligence and military services are on. There have been a number of reports that the ISI, Pakistan's intelligence service, has provided some support to the Taliban. There have also been reports from the border areas of Frontier Corps, Pakistani Frontier Corps, and army forces involved in direct artillery barrages against Afghan forces, and have come very close to direct engagement with U.S. forces on the ground. So I think there are certainly some questions about a willingness on the ground. The broader point here is there is pressure both domestically in Pakistan, but also growing internationally, and especially from the United States.
Evan Coleman, put this into perspective for us, sort of as a worldwide effort. We're talking specifically about the northwest region of Pakistan and its significance. But how significant is the spread of al-Qaeda to other parts of the world, North Africa, South Asia specifically?
Well, I mean, it's tremendously significant, and I think that's exactly what you're starting to see now, is almost a resurgence in the power of al-Qaeda's central leadership in Pakistan and Afghanistan, because of the fact that we haven't made that much progress in terms of eliminating them. You're starting to see organizations around the world, these franchise organizations, formally declare their allegiance to al-Qaeda, formally declare their willingness to serve under Osama bin Laden as their emir. And that is not something, that's not a move that an organization would take if they anticipated their leadership was about to be wiped out. I think they feel that their leaders are in a fairly secure position in Pakistan. Certainly al-Qaeda's media wing seems to feel so, because the Asahab media wing, which in the beginning released only a handful of videos out of security concerns, now releases dozens and dozens of videos, including a very senior al-Qaeda leaders, publishing them around the world in order to, you know, put out al-Qaeda's message, to reassure the franchise groups. But it's really astounding. I mean, if they had very serious security concerns about Dr. Ayman al-Zawahiri and other al-Qaeda leaders, I can't imagine they would be putting out this many audio and video recordings in such a short period of time.
Back to the phones. Now in Boston, Javid is calling. Javid, you're on the line. Hello.
Hi, Jane. Thank you for having me.
Sure.
My question is for Ahmad Rashid. Ahmed, I've been in Pakistan quite frequently lately. I'm working in the northern areas. I'm an engineer working on earthquake homes, etc. The question I have for you, Ahmed, is that we seem to be dealing with the symptoms and not the disease. What I have observed in Pakistan generally is that there's a huge resentment towards the United States because people feel that Americans are fighting a war against Muslims, whether it happens to be the one-sided support of Israel in Middle East or whether it happens to be Iraq. Now, do you think, I personally think that if America was to engage more actively in resolving the Middle East conflict, that all of these problems would go away and the Al-Qaeda would not be able to get the support that it's trying to garner among the common people in various Muslim countries.
Javed, thank you for your call. Ahmed, I'll turn it right over to you.
Well, yes, certainly. I mean, you know, if there was a more even-handed U.S. policy in the Middle East, I mean, it certainly would affect, and of course that, you know, there was not the war in Iraq. Of course it would affect people in Pakistan. But I think also what the biggest failure on the part of the government, I think, over the last few years has been to convince the people of Pakistan that this war against extremism is not America's war alone. It is also a war that Pakistan has to wage within itself against these extremists who are, you know, killing civilians by suicide bombs, etc. Now, I think, you know, what the military regime has failed to do, partly because it is a military regime, it's not an elected government, it's not a representative government, it has not been able to convince the people of Pakistan that this is their war, as it were. It's not just America's war. Now, and that, I think, partly is the reason why there has been this talk about a deal and possibly Bailey Bhutto coming back, a proper, a genuine civilian government, a representative government, which would do a better job at selling the war against extremism in Pakistan to Pakistan.
I'd like to close up this hour with you all just explaining or wrapping up as you see the future of terrorism as it relates to the Northwest region in Pakistan, this mountainous, remote region. Where do we go from here? Evan Coleman, let me start with you.
Sure. What I'm concerned about is this. I'm concerned about the lesson of the July 7th bombers in London reaching down to homegrown terrorist cells, both in the United States and the United Kingdom and beyond. And these people perceiving, increasingly so, Pakistan as a place where even if you have no prior connection to Al-Qaeda, even if you have no prior connection to Osama bin Laden, if you have the desire and the will to become a terrorist, you can go there and graduate from being a homegrown terrorist into being a hardcore central Al-Qaeda member being directed by Dr. Ayman al-Zawahiri. And I think we're starting to move into a situation where this is no longer theory, and this is fact, where even homegrown cells, people with no prior connection, are able to go to Pakistan and become the next 7/7 bombers.
Seth Jones, 30 seconds for you.
I think one key issue, pulls us back to history, and that is the U.S. military and the U.S. government more broadly cannot solve this problem in Pakistan with direct action. So the idea of sending U.S. military forces like the U.S. did to in Iraq in 2003 is not going to solve this problem, and I think it would clearly make it worse. I think what you have to go back to is two events historically in this region, very recent events. One is the CIA's involvement in the 1980s in countering the Soviet regime in Afghanistan.
Yep.
The argument was to use CIA forces and to work with the Pakistani government. 2001, there was a similar indirect approach, CIA and special forces working with local Afghan groups. I think an indirect approach working with local forces is the only solution.
Our time's up. I'll have to let that be the last word. Seth Jones from Arlington, Virginia, from the RAND Corporation. Thanks so much for your time. I appreciate it, Seth.
Thank you.
Evan Coleman, international terrorism consultant. Appreciate your time, Evan. Thank you.
Thank you.
And Ahmed Rashid, Pakistani journalist and best-selling author, widely regarded as the top expert on the Taliban and security issues in Central and South Asia. Ahmed, great to have you with us. Thanks.
Thank you.
I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.